Hey, if you're a journalist who uses the tool Help a Reporter Out, or Harrow, listen up. Harrow is moving to Cision's new app, Connectively. But what is Connectively? Well, imagine a place where you can quickly connect with expert sources for your next story. Connectively is a new app from Cision that's changing the way journalists, like us, content creators, experts and PRs work together. So if you're in search of credible sources, Connectively is your next stop. With just a click, you can publish your queries. These go straight to a feed where experts from loads of different backgrounds can respond, giving you their expertise. So go on, visit connectively.us to sign up for free. That's connectively.us. Connectively.us.
Hello and welcome to Freelancing for Journalists. I'm Lily, and in this series, we're going to be looking at ways of diversifying your income.
Yes, hi, I'm Emma, and this is a really exciting series because it talks about all the ways that we can use our skills as freelance journalists to have other income streams. In this episode, we've got two fantastic guests talking to us about report writing and translation, and they have loads and loads of practical advice for us. I'm really looking forward to that. But this week, before we start, Lily, let's talk about our win of the week.
Yes. Okay, shall I start?
Yes, please. Go for it.
Okay, so I think I mentioned in the last episode or a couple of episodes back that there was a pitch that I have been pitching for ages. I knew it was a good story. No one was biting. A bit of a bust, you know, no buses come along and then three turn up situation. So I got a commission that I mentioned last week. Now I've got a second commission for the same story. And I've let them know that I've already got a commission elsewhere, but they don't mind about that. So that's good. So I did fess up about that. So yeah, got two commissions out of this one story so far that I couldn't get anywhere a few weeks ago. So that's my little win.
Fantastic. Persistence pays off in the end.
Yes, it does. And patience as well, because they were interested and then went quiet and then came back to me about 3 weeks later. So yeah, sometimes it's just, I don't know, it disappears into a black hole and then bubbles up to the surface again.
Yeah, just bide your time.
Yeah. So what's your win, Emma?
Yeah, so mine is a bit of a side hustle that I've been working on. So I'm vice chair of the Medical Journalists Association, and for the past 2 years, this will be the third year, we've had an annual symposium, which was sort of my baby. This was an idea that I came up with, and so I've sort of been doing it since the beginning. But this is all done in my spare time. I don't get paid for this. I'm doing this on top of my other work. So it's really stressful. And I've just, this year, it's in April, and I have just confirmed all the speakers for the day, and we've got a really, really good lineup. So it's sort of a weight has been lifted because I finally got everybody in place. I've filled the program. We can start spreading the word and sharing it all. I also got my sister, who is a designer, to do the poster because my first go at it was absolutely appalling. I just think, know when something isn't in your wheelhouse and pass that on to someone else. So yeah, it's just that relief of something coming together in the end.
Yeah, well, sounds like a lot of hard work, but it's, yeah, very satisfying when it all pays off in the end. So well done for getting that all together. Fantastic. Okay, so let's introduce our guests, who both have lots of experience in the world of editing and translation.
Yes, today we have with us Judith Zerdin, who works as a freelance journalist, copywriter, and Spanish-French to English translator. Judith says that combining her writing languages and communication skills seemed like a natural career progression. She does translating and proofreading of website copy, and she also translates news script for digital TV channel Arte.
And we also have with us Priya Joy, an experienced freelance science journalist and communicator. In addition to her journalism work, Priya has a wealth of experience in writing and editing major global health reports and policy briefs for the World Health Organization, the UN, the Global Vaccine Alliance, and MSF. She also runs the Substack, The Art of Freelance.
Fantastic, Bae. Thank you for joining us today. We've got lots to dig into here because I feel like you've got so much experience in these areas that our listeners are going to want to hear about. In fact, Judith, when we mentioned translation, we actually had lots of people in the Facebook community saying, oh, I want to know more about this. I want to know about how to get into this. So could you start by telling us a bit about yourself, how you got into journalism and the sort of different types of work you now do as a freelance?
Yes. So I started off as a print journalist quite a long time ago. It was end of the last century, in fact. I did a postgraduate diploma in magazine journalism at Cardiff University, and that kind of just set me off, really. I worked in kind of local newspapers at the start of my career. Fast forward 17 years of like stints of freelancing and kind of moving countries. I lived in Colombia for a while. And I decided to diversify and train as a translator because I'd studied languages originally as an undergraduate. So I did that in 2017 for 2 years. I did it as a part-time, I did a master's in translation, and then set myself up as a freelance translator, as well as a freelance journalist and copywriter.
It's interesting that you did that, the course, the MA. Is that something, do you think that you do need the extra training in order to get into translating?
Yes. So it was recommended to me that was a good way in by a very good friend of my family who has been a translator for many years. I said to her, you know, if I wanted to go into translation, what's the best way? And she said, you should do a qualification, and a master's is the best thing because it's an academic qualification, and translation is quite an academic discipline, really. So yes, I would recommend it. Yeah.
Yeah, that's really interesting that you wouldn't necessarily automatically think about it as an academic subject, but actually, yeah, that does make sense. But Priya, if we come to you, can you tell us a bit more about, again, how you got into journalism, but also about the different types of work you do? And again, kind of how do you get into this world of report writing?
Yes. So I started out similarly to Judith. I did an MSc in science communication. And I'd had a science background already. I studied genetics. I did this master's. And then I went on to do two internships while I was there. One of them was for Radio 4 and the other one was for The Lancet. And I loved both of them, but there happened to be a job opening at The Lancet. And so I applied for it and I got it. So I kind of went into medical editing, medical writing first. And then while I was there, I started doing, there were parts of the journal that I could write for, like news and opinions. And I was quite young, journalist communicator, so I sort of really wanted to get experience in that. So I then started to write for those bits of the journal as well on the side, as well as editing. And I loved it so much. So that was my first foray into kind of journalism as well. And I'd learned feature writing and stuff while I was on my master's, but this was actually putting into practice. So then what I decided is that as much as I loved being in the medical journal world, I wanted to go and work for a new site. And so I went on to work for somewhere called SciDevNet. And then I was reporting on global health and that kind of thing for a few years, and then onto New Scientist. And then I sort of came back full circle a little bit where I really missed working for journals, because as a journalist, what I was doing is taking research and then sort of and then making it really easy to understand. But I really missed, as a former scientist, getting to grips with the science itself and like being kind of much more upstream in terms of publishing. And so I then started to continued journalism. I then went freelance And then I started trying to write more for places like WHO, the World Health Organization, for example. And that's when the sort of crossover happened into report writing and editing. And then I ended up doing both for quite a while. And then I've kind of carried on doing that more or less for about the last 15, 20 years now, because I really like the variety. I think being solely a news journalist can be really hard work. You're constantly chasing stories and you're constantly, you know, having to pitch. Report writing solely as well can be quite tough because you're immersed in this project for quite a while. So having the mix of the two, I think, is a really nice balance of a news piece could be like within the same day or 2 days, and report writing obviously goes on for a lot longer. So that's how I ended up here.
It's really interesting, Priya, because we had a really similar start to our careers. Basically, I mean, it's pretty much identical. You did the science communication course. Was that the one at Imperial?
That was right, yeah.
And I did a journalism master's after a science degree, and then started working at the Lancet. I was at the Lancet Oncology, and then wanted to do more news and more writing, so kind of looked for other opportunities. But I don't know that there's many people who start out in the same way that we did, so it's interesting to find someone whose career started in the same. I mean, when you decided you wanted to do sort of more of the reports writing side of things, you obviously had those connections through your work on writing about global development. How did you find those opportunities? Was it literally through the kind of connections that you already had and people who already knew you? How did you sort of find your way into that world, I suppose?
I did two things. One is that I put feelers out to people I knew who worked broadly within organizations. So they would, like, global health organizations that would commission reports or who would need writers and editors. And then the other thing is I kind of started to brand myself a little bit that way, like in my CV or on my LinkedIn. I don't think there was LinkedIn at the time, but whatever kind of online presence I had, I started to have those in there. Because if you're editing, as you know, if you're editing like a really big manuscript for a journal, it can be almost a bit like a short report where you've got a similar risk structure. And so I had all those skills already. I just started to make them a lot more visible. So then I tapped into a contact that I had at the World Health Organization, and I got like a short report to do. But once I had that and it was done and they didn't have any more work for me, then I went into a good old freelance hustle where I would head over to Geneva, try and meet people. Scientists and people who work in science generally are quite approachable, I find. Like, everyone likes to talk about their work. And I would just try and meet people for like a coffee and say, and then talk to them about the type of work that I did and the kind of breadth of experience that I had. And that's sort of how it then went on. I got a couple more reports, and then sometimes I'd be asked to edit, sometimes I'd be asked to write it from scratch. But yeah, so it sort of built from there. I did get one contact, but then there was a lot of hustling to keep that flow of work coming.
Yeah, and it's interesting, isn't it, how no matter what kind of discipline you're in, when you're freelancing, it is, isn't it, part of that hustle and making those contacts. I mean, Judith, what was the situation for you? How did you start picking up that translation work?
So about halfway through my master's, I started just applying to agencies, which is where the majority of my work still comes from. We had a couple of careers fairs at the university, and representatives from various language agencies, translation and interpreting agencies, came along, and you kind of signed up with them, and then you had to, you know, send a few more follow-up emails and say, you know, I'm available and stuff. And I got my first couple of clients that way, because that's the best way. I found that was the best way for me to start getting the work. It's a bit with translation, I mean, with everything really, but with translation particularly, it's a bit of a chicken egg situation that you don't have experience, so you contact an agency and they say, well, we want 3 years experience or something. So it's quite hard at the beginning, but there were a couple of agencies that took students on So I just started with them, and they're still my main clients now, among my main clients.
And does it ever then work out that clients might come to you directly once you start working for them, that it leads to sort of more longer term contracts, or does it keep going back through those agencies?
I haven't really had any contracts as such. It's once an agency knows you and you're kind of on their list, their freelance list, they will contact you, whenever there's work coming in. I've had people contact me. The Arte job came through LinkedIn. They were looking for a translator with a journalism background. I don't know any other translators who also have a journalism background. So she contacted me through LinkedIn and asked me if I was interested, and it just kind of went from there. I've been doing that for over a year now. It can be word of mouth as well. I find that other translators, once they know you, if you join networks and things, they can put work your way.
Yeah, it's that mix, isn't it, of sort of branding yourself, getting yourself known in the right places, getting sort of repeat work and, getting recommendations. Priya, I mean, have you found that's the same for you when it comes to your branding? Because, there's lots of sort of strings to your bow. How do you go about sort of selling yourself, I suppose, making sure people know what your skills are?
I mean, now I find, probably compared to when I first went freelance, which was a good 20 years ago, because there are so many kind of digital spaces where we can be seen, like lots of people have websites now, at least one or two social media channels. I think thinking about that in quite a savvy way, like some people I know might have a website, but then their social media doesn't make it clear who they are. So on mine, what I try and do is show a diversity of skills, but still something that kind of pulls it all together. So I really like talking, and I like presenting, and I like training people, and kind of things that are quite communal and that involve other people. So I try as much as possible to make that clear on, say, my LinkedIn, for example. And I try and have also personal things as much as I can, as much as is appropriate, to sort of show a bit of me, like videos and things like that, because I think it can be really hard when you're just looking at like a paper CV or an online CV to know what someone is really like how they talk, how they come across, and all of that kind of stuff. So yeah, I mean, I think it's a lot easier to be visible these days.
Yeah, and it's really interesting from what you're both saying that, Priya, you're more kind of reaching out to people, building those contacts, whereas Judith, it's more the agency work. It's kind of understanding your field, isn't it, and where those opportunities are. I mean, Judith, I just wanted to come back to you because I'm interested. You said that the job that you're still working on now, they wanted a journalist. Do you find that there are skills that you have as a journalist, in obviously in this job, but in other jobs, that kind of cross over with the translation work?
I'd say the main skill is being able to write well. So when I was first thinking about going into translation, the friend who I mentioned and said, oh, you know, as a journalist, you'll do really well as a translator, because you basically, as well as the language skills, you basically have to be a good writer. You have to be able to write in fluent English, good English that sounds like a native person wrote it from scratch, even though it's a translation. You know, your grammar has to be impeccable, your sentence structure, everything. So I would say that's the main skill that overlaps. You don't really have the people contact, because you're kind of, on a computer just getting emails and stuff, except when you're networking, I suppose. That's, that's obviously where face-to-face connections are important. But I would say I've definitely got an advantage as a writer.
And are the expectations quite clear, I suppose, about what's expected of you? Do you get kind of a clear brief when you're doing translation work? Is there kind of a back and forth process if someone wants something changed? How does that, do you find that kind of similar or very different to your journalism work?
No, it's pretty different, I would say. It depends on the client. Sometimes the agencies generally are, well, can give you clear briefs, and sometimes they don't give you very clear briefs, and you have to go back to them and say, well, you know, how do you want this? What, you know, what do you mean by blah blah blah? And then they come back to you eventually. But no, it totally depends on the client as to how clear it is that what they're looking for, really.
Yeah, it sounds similar to copywriting. We recorded an episode last week about that, and talking about briefs and how sometimes it's not always clear, or the client themselves is not clear themselves what they actually want. So yeah, it's interesting that sort of sounds like it also happens in translation.
Yeah.
And Priya, I wonder how it works then with kind of report writing. Is there a team around you that you're working through, or are you working sort of individually, like directly with the client? What's the setup there?
So I generally work directly with a client, and in terms of how many, any team would usually be on their side. So they would probably hire a separate freelance designer, someone to do the layout and stuff. And then clients are really varied in how they are in their communication. Sometimes there's one point of contact, and then it's between me and that person who's commissioned the work, and then they go and collate. Usually people have to, you know, run drafts through internal processes and stuff. Sometimes, and I prefer it when it happens that way, because then I'm not having to, sometimes I've been in situations where there are four or five people, technical people, who all need to weigh in. They're all in an email. They've got conflicting comments from each other. and then I'm sort of left in the decision-making seat, which I really don't like. And as I've become more experienced, I feel much more comfortable saying, like, taking decisions when I can or when I feel able to. But sometimes if it's, for example, like a recommendation at the end of a report, I do put that back on them. And I say, you need to come to a collective decision and then come back to me. And then sometimes I do work directly with the designers as well, and that can be really nice because they're both interpreting, I guess, the central messages of the report, but just in slightly different ways. So that is always nice when I can collaborate with a designer, especially on things like graphics. Scientific reports often have the graphics, and the illustrations can be really central to understanding the content. So that's really enjoyable when I can do it, but otherwise it can be a bit of a solitary affair, just kind of chugging away through a big report.
Yeah, I think you must have a lot more patience than me, Priya, because if I'm sometimes I've been in situations where I'm doing a piece of work and it's a really big team and everybody wants to weigh in or have an opinion or feel like, and it's just kind of writing by committee, and I at that point I sort of lose the will. So I'm in awe of anyone who has the patience to sort of manage that process. Yeah. But the other thing is, it is a really lengthy process. So how do you get paid for that? Is it by project? Is it sort of a day rate? How does that work?
So clients maybe want to do different things. I now very firmly work on a day rate. So I will estimate a number of days for a project, and then I will always allow for extra days, because usually when clients create a contract and they've allowed for, let's say, 10 days, if they then want to add days, it always becomes a lot more traumatic. Whereas if I've said it could be 10 to 14 days and I will bill you for the number of days, that's what I find really works well. And really protects me, because as a freelancer, like, no one is protecting the fact that I need to be paid for my work, or I need to be paid for if a project turns into something that it's not, that I am my own advocate. And so, yeah, I very, very rarely agree to a project rate unless the project rate is so far above what I think it's going to take me, even allowing for things to go wrong. Then I might do, but it's extremely rare that I take that on. And actually, it's better for the client as well, because then they're paying for the time that you've spent on it, rather than having agreed to like a huge sum, and then it maybe takes you, you know, a lot less.
Yeah, yeah. And setting those expectations out right at the beginning is really useful for everyone. So yeah, everyone knows where they stand. And Judith, how does that work in translation then? Is there a set fee for a project or per word? How does it work?
Yeah, translation is usually paid per word. And it, as to whether it's the translator or the client who sets that rate, it depends. Usually with an agency, they tell you what they're happy to pay. Even if they ask you at the beginning, you know, to give us your rates, you know that if you go in too high, they're just going to say, forget it. Or they'll try and kind of, you know, get you to come down. So it's per word. With Arte, I get paid per video minute because it's a script, so it depends on how long the videos are. We don't really have project fees or anything because of the translations. Even if it's a long project, like last year I was translating a kind of a small book. Well, it was a large booklet. From French into English about rivers. It was kind of, you know, there were chapters. It took me a couple of months to do, but I was still paid per word.
Right.
So, yeah.
And how does it compare to journalism, the rate? Is it similar or higher or lower?
Well, it's hard to say because I've never been paid per word in journalism. So it's really hard to say. I mean, generally I would say that translation isn't that well paid. It could be better paid than journalism because, I mean, I know that some journalism is really badly paid as well. So it's really hard to say, but probably, it also depends on the time it takes. So it could take, like, you know, writing a feature could take a week or 2 weeks or something, and you get paid whatever at the end of it. £200 or £300 or what, but you know, depending on who you're writing for. Whereas translation, it probably won't take as long, but it won't take as long as many days, but it might take more hours because you have to think a bit more. It's just a different way of thinking. So it's just hard to compare, really.
Yeah. I mean, I think what's clear from both of you is that you're kind of quite clear from the start about expectations, trying to think about how long something should take, how much work it's going to be. And actually, we should all be taking that into account in our journalism work as well. Kind of, Lily and I have had these discussions where it might not seem like an article, that the rate for an article is very high, but actually, you know, you can knock it out in half a day, so it's fine. You're sort of kind of trying to take that into account. And I mean, the other thing that our listeners always want to know about is how people juggle the different parts of their freelance and how they divide up their time, I suppose, and make sure that they're devoting the right amount of time to the right things. Priya, you've got your newsletter as well, The Art of Freelance, and I know this is something that you think about quite a lot, about how to make the most of your time. How do you divide up and decide what, you know, how much you're going to spend on what part of it?
Yeah, what I've started doing in the last maybe 6 months or so was time blocking. So basically looking at my week, I might do this on a weekend, I might do it like Monday morning or something, and then just kind of knowing what I have to do that week and allocating chunks of time, more or less, because once I start doing that, so I know by now how much time a 2,000 word feature might take me, or how much time a 10 page report might take me to edit. And I allocate chunks of time and I try and mix it so that I'm not doing just report writing, whatever, for days on end, because that gets quite tedious. And then I become really granular where I put in breaks and I put in like go to the gym and all of this, because then I can see my week. And although, like, when my husband looks at my calendar, he goes, "When it looks really stressful, like there's things in different colours." But to me, it's quite soothing because I know, okay, I'm going to be able to get most of this report done this week. I'm still going to have breaks and time to do whatever. I maybe do my emails in the morning. I usually have a morning call with one of my main clients, Gavi, at 9:30. So I know I need to build that in. And it really just kind of allows me to see where I'm spending my time, how much time I'm allocating, because I think we've all had this situation where we think something's going to take us a few days and it ends up taking us so much longer, or we're not even aware of how long something's taken us. And so then your fee is effectively, if it's like a set fee, is getting it's shrinking by the every hour and every day that you spend on it, you know, that's over what you thought. So I kind of like map out my week that way. I try not to go more than a week or two in advance, because otherwise it will just start to feel like I'm, I don't know, some crazy CEO who's going from meeting to meeting. But it, yeah, I find it really helps, and it actually makes me much more conscious of how much time I'm spending on something. And then I can actually, if it's a project that's lasted a month, I can then look back and say with confidence to a client that, oh, it's taken me this much time. I know some people who use their various apps, can't remember what they're called now, but there are apps where you can log, you know, when you start a thing and log off or whatever. That's a bit too granular for me, but yeah, mapping out my agenda, my kind of diary, really helps at the start of the week.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I would like to be more like that, to kind of, yeah, to be able to visualize it. But I just find that my work is so flexible and that I'm always doing different things, or something else is coming up, or I want to fit in something personally, or something's happening with the kids, that I worry that if I had those blocks of time and then I was breaking them or moving them all the time, that I'd feel like I was failing in some way. But I do like the idea of logging, like how much time you're spending on stuff, although I think that probably works better for longer term projects. Maybe it's not possible if you're sort of churning out a lot of copy a week. And just as an aside, we did do a episode on time management in a previous series that I'll put a link to, which we talked about some of those apps, because Anna Harding uses a lot of apps for all of her organization, and she's one of those like granular people that seems to be on top of it all. I'm much more pen and paper. Judith, how about you? How do you kind of organize your week and all the different things you do?
Well, I'm a bit similar to you, because my work is very flexible. I don't really have a plan. I don't block out time, because also I just, from one week to the next, I rarely know what's going to come in that week. So I could have a day of, you know, where nothing comes in, and then I'm just kind of trying to do some CPD, or I'm doing an online copywriting course at the moment to just kind of hone my skills there. So I do that, you know, a bit of the time if I've got a spare couple of hours. And translations can just come into my inbox anytime during the day, and I'll just, if I've got the time and I know that I'm going to be able to do it before picking the kids up from school or whatever, and I don't have to work in the evenings, then I'll say yes, or I might negotiate deadline. And it is quite flexible, can be flexible. You can negotiate deadlines and say, actually, I can't do it today. Would 11 o'clock tomorrow morning be okay? And then, and journalism is just kind of, it's my own time anyway. I don't have anyone asking me to do stuff, really. I mean, copywriting I do when that comes in. But yeah, journalism is also something I kind of just do when, you know, when I've got the time, when I'm not doing the translation. So it's very, yeah, it's flexible. Yeah.
Yeah, I think I was nodding a lot when Lily was speaking, because I think I land somewhere between both of you in that I am trying really hard to block out bigger chunks of time for things, especially when you've got those longer term projects, that because a lot of my journalism is kind of a news story here or a little feature here, and I'm juggling lots of things, and so you can go in and out of it, and I'm so easily distracted. Like every time an email comes in, I will answer it immediately, but I am finding I am having to do that. Right, this afternoon is only going to be for this, and I'm turning everything off so that I can concentrate on this in order to do a good job. So I'm a work in progress, but we're trying to find the right balance of those two things. I think our final question for both of you really is on your separate areas, is what advice you would have for someone who's looking to get into this type of work, your sort of top tip. So Priya, I'll come to you first. If someone is looking into getting into kind of report writing, editing, kind of this more formal kind of projects, what would your sort of key bit of advice for them be?
So I would say, if this is a journalist going into trying to get into report writing and editing, I would put together a few clips or a few, like a little portfolio of my longer form pieces, because the more long form a piece of journalism, the more closely it resembles a report. And then I would reach out to like the communications teams, usually in big organizations, from whatever field you're trying to get into or that you already work in. I think aiming for those comms teams, because even if they're not the ones who would be commissioning reports, they usually know, if it's like a big organization with different departments, they will usually know people who do, and they can put you in touch. So I think just getting together a nice little portfolio of things that resemble report writing, even if you've never done it before, a cover letter explaining why you'd be really good at it, and then just like contacting kind of a massive blast of like loads of comms people would be probably a really good first way to get into it.
Yes, because there's all sorts of organisations, charities, groups who would potentially use those skills. So it's just about finding those that are in the field that you're interested in or write about most often. And Judith, when it comes to translation, have you got a sort of one bit of advice for someone who's thinking, you know, maybe they are bilingual, you know, they've got strong language skills, but they're just not sure about taking that next step? What would your sort of key tip be?
Well, my key tip would also be to take a to do a qualification in it, not necessarily a master's, because there are diplomas and things you can do as well. The Institute of Translation and Interpreting, the ITI, is like the industry body for translation and interpreting. They have a lot of resources on their website and suggestions and things, and they list all the universities that have like translation courses. That's the best way, and I find because then people, once you've got that qualification under your belt, agencies and potential clients are going to be hopefully more likely to give you some work.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, that's been so helpful, and lots of practical advice there actually at the end to wrap up, which is great. And I'll dig out a link to that interpretation body that you just mentioned and put that in the show notes. But thank you both so much. And before we kind of sign off completely, though, we want to come to you to get a recommendation of a piece of work by another freelancer to share the freelance love, as it were. So Priya, what's your recommendation?
My recommendation is a piece in The Guardian by my friend Linda Geddes. So she's another science writer that I used to work with on New Scientist. And she just has a brilliant way of writing. And this is a piece about lab-grown meat. So lab-grown meat that we might eat. And so people are really taking this to a next level where they're almost making this gourmet. So I would highly recommend. It's got something like, she goes through like a 6-course imagined menu of things like foie gras and all of this kind of stuff, but all grown in a petri dish.
As a vegetarian, that doesn't exactly appeal to me, but it does sound interesting. So I'll go and find that, and we'll add that to the show notes. And Judith, what's your recommendation?
Well, I follow a lady called Ariane Shireen, who is a comedy writer and comedian. She's been published in The Guardian and lots of other places, and she's got a blog on Substack, and she wrote recently. I mean, she writes really funny. I really like her blogs because they're just really funny, and she's very self-deprecating, but just really clever as well. And she wrote one recently about why I legally changed my name 5 times, and it's just about how she's had so many different identities and passports, and she kind of delves into her background and the reasons why. It's just really interesting. It's quite off topic, and I just find her really funny.
That's great. I love those pieces that are just kind of really random, or just looking at something from a completely different perspective and making you smile. That's always worth doing, isn't it? So we'll add all of those links so that everyone can go and look at these fantastic recommendations.
That's it for this episode. If you want bonus podcast episodes, you can become a premium newsletter subscriber where you get access to an extra weekly newsletter and all kinds of resources. You can find everything else on our website at freelancingforjournalists.com. And also, big thanks to our producer, Maddie Drury.
Yep, and we'll be back again next week. But until then, goodbye.
Bye.